Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
What they've done is truly, I mean, it's a service to the state and their motivation. And I could just to stress that again, their motivation this week was not to tell the country how bad this man was and how much they suffered. Their motivation was to tell the country the system has to change. This can't happen again. And they really seem to want to labour that point. And I think that's, you know, it's important to recognise that.
I'm Nicola Tallant and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe.
Serial child abuser Bill Kenneally sparked outrage when he joked and laughed through testimony at a public inquiry this week. Kenneally appeared to relish the attention as he described how Gardaí had known about his crimes since 1987. But behind the headlines caused by Kenneally's testimony, the inquiry is seeking to discover how the state failed his victims. Today, I'm speaking to reporter Saoirse McGarrigle about the work of the Commission of Inquiry. I'm Niall Donald, and this is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Saoirse, thanks for joining us. The sight of a paedophile smirking, joking, laughing about the abuse he committed must have been a particularly horrific and traumatic sight for the victims this week. You were in court to hear Bill Kenneally give his evidence. What was his manner like?
It was unnerving, I think, for everybody in the room. So we were all, you know, shaking our heads, you know, trying not to look at the victims to see how they would react. But I mean, we were all thinking the same thing. This is uncomfortable for everybody in the room, lawyers, reporters. How could the victims sit through what he had to say? It was just the most unusual situation. I mean, now you know better than anyone what it's like covering, you know, a courtroom situation. So often with a paedophile and a case like that, they will claim, you know, they will plead not guilty. They will so often not give evidence. But this was just completely different. You know, the room wasn't set up like a traditional courtroom. He was sworn in. He took the religious oath. He did sit there. Essentially, he was a witness, but this wasn't a court proceeding. This was a public inquiry. And I felt all along, having followed the story, that he was probably going to speak very honestly, because the tone of his angry letters that he seems to be shooting off to everybody who will entertain him is that he has been wronged. That essentially, because the Gardaí, the authorities knew that he was abusing these boys back in the 80s, had he been dealt with then, he would have received, you know, a far less, you know, harsh penalty. I think one of the things that really, I suppose, attracted my attention was that from the minute he walked in, and I suppose just to paint a picture of this, I mean, I think we always wonder when we get a chance to see a prisoner when he's come out from behind bars, how will he look? Like, will he look different? You know, how has life behind bars treated him? I know you had the story a couple of months ago that he was on hunger strike ahead of his trial, where he was accused of abusing three other boys, now men in their 40s and 50s. But I mean, hunger strike was obviously in the distant past. He was still, you know, how he looks in all of the photographs we've had up until this point, you know, short, stout, he came in, you know, spruced up in his suit. But I think, like, we often see in the photos when prisoners come out of prison, when they've been released, they have their little plastic bag and all their, you know, their belongings there. He came in, and as soon as the handcuffs were taken off, he clutched onto this little bag, and it was very unusual. He pulled out stacks of papers, a big blue folder, and he shuffled them about. It was like he wanted to look like he was a lawyer.
Do you think he was even enjoying the attention? I mean, because...
Oh, he thrived on it.
Yeah. I mean, this is the... Like, he's been through, obviously, to go back to the story from the very start. He has been... He's currently serving a very lengthy prison sentence for the abuse of, I think it's, is it 15 boys in total? How did you first come across this story, Saoirse? Because you've played a key role in even in this commission being set up.
Yeah, well, in 2016, I would just correct you there. I don't feel like I've played a key role. I mean, the victims have, they have put themselves out there. They have bravely waived their anonymity. This is a credit to them, their strength. And I think their families probably don't get the credit they deserve. I mean, I've got to know some of their wives, and they're just truly remarkable women that, you know, we probably overlook the contribution that they have had to make to this whole process, which inevitably, I hope, will benefit society. That is the point of this inquiry. Like, this inquiry is not to establish, you know, how evil this man was, how horrific his crimes were. We know that already. Sadly, we know that. And these men have known that for decades. This is to establish how society failed, failed the children, failed to rescue them when they should have been saved. But I suppose back to the beginning of the campaign for the commission, I met with Jason Clancy in May of 2016. Now, he's the man who kickstarted the criminal investigation in 2012. I just to give you a little bit of a background, because I think it's quite interesting. He is a businessman in Waterford, father of four. And one day he just decided, where is Bill Keneally now? Like, where did he end up? Did he ever get caught? Googled him, found that he was still coaching a basketball team. And that just horrified him. He said, look, you know what he was doing in the 80s. And he now still has access to children. And this was 2012. So when he made that complaint, then that led to the Garda investigation, which ultimately led to his conviction in 2016. But it didn't stop there for Jason. He was adamant that there needed to be a bigger investigation. People, you know, the state needed to look at how this went on for so long, how he was left to have access to children for so long. I met Jason. He then introduced me to some of the other victims, Paul Walsh, Colin Power, Kevin Keating, Barry Murphy. They're all truly, I mean, they're whistleblowers, but they're incredibly courageous men. One or two others as well, who I won't name. They have never waived their anonymity, but they have also played a crucial role. But Jason explained to me that he felt something else had to happen, but he wasn't sure what could happen. And at that point, I remember kind of scratching my head, thinking, this is not a normal story. You know, we cover stories of paedophiles when they go to court. You know, we write about what happens when they get locked up. You know, this is not your ordinary situation. And I got the impression from what he was saying that he wanted some sort of legal investigation. But I didn't understand how that whole concept of a public inquiry would work, or even if that was appropriate. So I don't know if you recall the story at the time, but a solicitor, Dara Mackin in the north, he was actually working alongside Amal Clooney, George Clooney's wife. He covered the Hooded Men case. That was in the papers at the time. And I just said, you know what, like a, you know, wild card. I tried to contact this solicitor and ask him, you know, how would a story like this proceed? I suppose, like for you and I, you're always trying to find a hook for a story. How do you make it a story? You know, how will we nose off? And I felt maybe if I could understand how something like this would progress legally, that would be a way to pursue the story. And from there, it sort of snowballed because, you know, much to my surprise and I suppose secretly my delight, Dara agreed to meet with these men. From the get-go, he agreed to represent them pro bono, never sought a penny. And I remember the first time I spoke with him, he said, Saoirse, if what you've written to me is true, it's the wildest thing I've ever read. And he said, you know, he just recently said, you know, it is the wildest thing.
Because you are, of course, hearing like why it's different than an ordinary, if you could call any case an ordinary abuse case. Because this week, Bill Keneally gave evidence himself about how he was brought into a Garda station. He admitted to six or seven young boys at that stage. And despite that admission, despite the fact that other people surrounding him knew what he was doing, he walked out of that Garda station. And as he said himself, no Garda got in touch with him again for 25 years.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think even to go further, what we heard on the second day of his testimony was he confirmed that if he had have been approached in 1985, which is 2 years before that meeting took place, had the Gardaí raided his home or his car at that point, they would have found Polaroids of naked young schoolboys, builder's twine used to tie up these children, handcuffs he used during these horrendous sexual attacks. And the reason I say 1985 is because I've spoken with one victim who has confirmed that he went to the Gardaí himself, a schoolboy. It was in around the time of his junior cert. He walked in, he was 15. He told the Gardaí at the counter that he had been abused just the day before. He was very upset. And he was, once he disclosed the name of the abuser, Bill Keneally, he felt the response changed. He was told to go home. He wouldn't be allowed to make a report because he was underage. And I think for me, one of the most twisted details in that particular scenario was that as a boy who'd just been injured, you know, no doctor was called. He was just left to walk home.
It's incredible. I mean, I know this is the late 80s when all of this is occurring. But I mean, and you know, and I'm significantly older than yourself, but like, and of course, attitudes were different to child sex abuse. There's no doubt about it. But the idea that people didn't know it was wrong or damaging, I think, is also not credible. I mean, what happened, of course, in Bill Keneally's case was, you know, and this is part of what the commission is looking at, he wasn't really an ordinary citizen, was he? Especially in that local area.
No, I mean, that came up within just minutes into the inquiry. Minutes within to his cross-examination by the lawyer for the victims. He raised the profile, I guess, that he came from. He came from a family steeped in politics in Fianna Fáil. His grandfather, his uncle, his first cousin had all served as TDs. They had at different points had seats on the city council. They had what I can only describe as a business empire that included pubs and also a bus fleet. They had money and they had power. That's the most simple way to explain it to your audience. They had money and they had power and they used that influence. Because as you know, in politics, the image matters. So this story could not get out.
Yes. And of course, we've also heard from some of his relatives, and we've also heard his own testimony about how he was treated by the Gardaí. I mean, what is he saying when he admits child sex abuse to the guards in an interview? What did he tell us about their reaction to that admission?
Like, this is the most bizarre part of it, is because we assume that criminals will try to hide what they do. But in this case, my perception is that when the criminal knows that they're going to get away with it, that the state is going to protect them, they'll speak freely. He told the Gardaí at that point in 1987 that, yes, he was abusing boys. We learned this week that the number of boys that he admitted he was abusing was 7. During these attacks, he was using handcuffs. He didn't hold back. And yet it didn't seem to make a difference. But I think that just maybe touches on the level of arrogance that we witnessed this week. He not only spoke very openly about the use of handcuffs in the attacks, he even joked at one point that they have become a popular, you know, sex prop in the last 2 years. It was like he really enjoyed, I would go as far as saying, it was like watching someone take a trip down memory lane. And he would smile at the victims while he spoke about it. It was really an incredibly uncomfortable situation. And I think I kind of echo what other reporters felt in the room at the same time, really. It was just a very, very uncomfortable story to cover this week.
Yeah, because as you say, like, I've been in child sex abuse cases, and I don't think I can think of a single time where any of the people on trial have made any admissions. I mean, I have been in cases where people have pled not guilty and just denied everything. But to actually hear somebody sit in a public forum and justify child sex abuse, like, It is truly shocking. I mean, he seemed to go back to this thing of, you know, you're talking about boys 14, 15, all well under the age of consent. But he seemed to even deny there was an age of consent at one point, and also just kept saying, justifying it through saying there was no resistance. It's sick, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it became clear through comments that the chairman, former High Court Judge Michael White, made it. There are a certain number of reporting restrictions around some of the issues arising from his insistence that that the abuse was consensual by some party. So I would treat that whole area with a little bit of, I suppose, I have reservations around discussing that. It was at one point one of the victims did leave the room. His wife followed him. It was just too hard to stomach. That was the way he described it. I think the other thing, just to come back to when you made the comment there about the 1980s, in 2016, I went to it was a parochial house in Tremore. It was the home of Monsignor John Shine, who is the uncle, was the uncle, he's since passed away, of Bill Keneally. He was his mother, Bill Keneally's mother's brother. And at one point this week, Bill Keneally joked that, you know, oh, sure, every family had a priest back then, trying to play down the fact that he had this connection to someone quite senior in the diocese who, it would appear, was able to use that also, that power to leverage the situation. At that point, I'm just reminded, this is 2016. This is not the 1980s. That man was actually the chairperson of the board of management for a primary school. And I mean, everyone, I suppose, will understand the basic premise of a board of management is to ensure the safety of the children, you know, Garda vetting, child protection. That responsibility of that rests solely, but with the board of management. He was the chairperson of that. That was for the victims at that point so, you know, hurtful that this man had already gone to jail. We knew at this point that Monsignor Shine knew his nephew was a paedophile and essentially did everything to protect him. And yet still, just 8 years ago, he was the chairperson of a board of management. And I will be at pains to stress that that school is entirely separate from this story. The staff in that school, you know, are completely, I mean, they were at the mercy of the diocese who had appointed him to be the chairperson of that board of management. And I always just want to stress that point. But that's hard for me to get my head around. That's only 8 years ago. That's not the 1980s. That's telling us that someone who saw fit to protect a paedophile still had a role of authority and significant responsibility in a primary school.
Yes. Yeah, so, and of course, Monsignor Sine mustn't, under any illusions, that his nephew was an innocent man, that there was allegations against him, but it hadn't been proved, because he'd recommended him attend a psychiatrist at that time, hadn't he?
Yeah. I mean, I guess having reported on the story, I knew that he had been involved in the meeting in 1987 and the subsequent arrangements to have Bill Keneally see a psychiatrist. But we got that from the horse's mouth this week. We had Bill Keneally confirm the arrangements that happened. And I suppose just mentioning their psychiatrist, that also brings us into the whole area of discussing the role of the Southeastern Health Board, what is now the HSC. During this whole story and I guess, of course, you know, reporting on it, I have met one victim who has, you know, recalled the whole experience of going to a doctor, a psychologist in Waterford City, in a HSC office, and telling that doctor that he was being abused. We have, you know, he has since under FOI obtained his files. It's there in black and white. He had told a doctor in the 1980s what had happened to him. From my recollection of the wording of that doctor's letter, it's made clear that this particular victim told the doctor that there was, you know, threats and money involved, and that basically he was left in fear, and that wasn't enough. I mean, that's not just, I think so often in Ireland we tend to focus on the Catholic Church being, you know, implicit in an orchestrated cover-up. That's the Department of Health, and I think perhaps it's something to watch out for in the final report. I think we're going to hear a lot more about the role that different, I guess, you know, authorities such as the Department of Health had in terms of, you know, covering up these crimes, or at a very minimum, failing to act properly.
Yeah, because of course the church has been through these commissions before the Ryan Commission and others as well. And, you know, it's looked at the structure that allowed these things to continue. Obviously, you know, individual sex offenders emerge in organisations, but it's when people know and it's allowed to continue. And that is really what this commission is looking at. Was there a structure that allowed, you know, and those connections that exist, did that allow this to go on and on? I mean, you can, anybody who even just reads it can see the great evil of this man. And he really, you know, if from 1987 until 2012, he remained involved with children in various forms through nearly all that time, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was only removed from the basketball club in April of 2013. I remind people when they talk about this story, don't get hung up on the fact that, you know, so many of the crimes happened in the 1980s. You know, this whole story extends, you know, into the very recent past. But just what you touched on there about the fact that he was allowed to continue. I spoke with one of the victims just this morning, and he stressed that he has a very real concern. You know, now that the dust has settled, it's been a couple of days, you know, a lot of people have reacted and shown such support for him and the other victims and their families, horrified by the level of you know, horrific detail that's come out. He's concerned that perhaps the narrative is focusing on the evil acts of this villain and not looking at the fact that the inquiry's role is to investigate the matters surrounding the response to the claims by the victims. And just to put it very simply, what he's saying is, we know he's a bad man. We know what we went through is truly horrific. However, can you please keep your eye on the focus of this inquiry is to look at how the system facilitated this, and hopefully that lessons will be learned from, you know, from the final report. But he is this morning very concerned that we're not focusing on the problem, you know, is to look at how the system, as he said, it didn't just fail, you know, it was part of an orchestrated cover-up. And he used those really strong words, and he's entitled to it. It's his situation, it's his story, it's his fear. But he did say to me, and I suppose this kind of alarmed me to some extent, was that he is worried that if a final report finds that it was just a series of systemic failures, which is often the terminology that we hear, that won't be enough. He said it's not enough to say the system failed, which is what we so often say, isn't it, in situations like this. He said we need to get to the core of the problem, and that was that very powerful people were able to leverage power over the authorities, the statutory organisations that were responsible for keeping children safe. So I think that's something just to, I guess, for your audience, you know, to bear in mind. The purpose of the exercise this week was to learn, you know, the witnesses' testimony and how that would feed into the greater work of the inquiry. And it wasn't just to hear how horrible this man was. So and just, I suppose, a little bit of a nerdy history around this. But this is the first time in about 20 years that a public inquiry dealing with sexual abuse has held a public hearing. And I think that's something that's very significant for the victims. They fought really, really hard to have this held in public because they felt, what's the point in doing it behind closed doors? You know, the taxpayers spend millions on inquiries for so many different issues. And I mean, I would struggle to count how many inquiries I've heard of in the last couple of years. But this one is different. This is being heard in public. This is why it was so, you know, such unfamiliar territory for everybody in the room, because we're not used to hearing this level of detail and testimony, you know, in public. And I think they really seem to admire the staff and particularly the chairman himself. I mentioned there, he's retired High Court Judge Michael White. His whole approach and the way he managed even the testimony during the week. At one point, he reminded Bill Keneally, he used the terminology, he wasn't going to let him turn it into a circus. He very much has managed the tone and how the inquiry has played out. And I think the victims are really, you know, satisfied with that. And that's also interesting because so often victims complain that they are left, you know, frustrated with how, you know, how these inquiries roll on. And certainly they did have a lot of, you know, very grave concerns about the inquiry in the earlier stages. But right now they seem to be satisfied with how the chairman did manage the situation during the week.
Yeah, because he's obviously in a difficult position where he wants Bill Keneally to give evidence. He wants him to give that evidence freely from his own mouth, but also has to be aware of, as you said, you know, allowing, you know, obviously a circus to occur or allow him to downplay or, you know, downplay the abuse, which he did repeatedly. And, you know, it's, and you are, of course, right that this commission has been going on for a number of months. We've reported on it. Other people have, but maybe only this week has some of that evidence reached a bigger audience, I suppose, given the nature of Bill Keneally's testimony.
Yeah. And I think I've heard that, and you will have heard as well, that term victim blaming so often. And yet this was a very strange situation. I was actually watching someone blame victims. He sat there and just, I suppose, to try and paint a picture for you of what it was like. It wasn't a traditional courtroom. It was a committee room that was set up with a desk at the front where the chairman sat and a smaller table beside him. And essentially, Bill Keneally was taking centre stage. And he used that platform. I said to someone before, it wasn't like a witness box. It was like a soapbox.
Yeah.
You know, he locked up for 8 years and now he was ready to tell his story. He was ready to blame everybody else except for himself.
It is shocking because, of course, he's been through two lengthy criminal trials. He's heard victim impact reports. He's obviously in prison. I don't know if he's undergoing treatment in there as part of sex offender rehabilitation. But the reality is, you know, he's heard this in court over 10 years. He's had so much time to reflect on it. And he remains absolutely unreformed and unrepentant. I mean, it's really is quite hard to get your head around, is it? That kind of, that just lack of humanity.
Yeah, well, I'm quite glad I'm not a criminologist. I just had to sit there and write the facts because there was a lot of things that came up that I just struggled to understand. I mean, just a couple of anecdotes. He referred to the fact that during one appointment with a psychiatrist who is now deceased, that the issue of prescribed medication came up, where the psychiatrist had suggested that there was some medication that could be prescribed to him to suppress his urges, as he described them, but that he wouldn't buy this medication because it would mean he would have to go into his local chemist and people would ask questions. There was little points like that where I just stopped and I felt like I had to put the pen down and just think, what is going on?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, a little bit of embarrassment is for him is a bigger cost than abusing a child. And we all know the lifelong impact that sort of abuse has had. I mean, it is, you know, it is genuinely, it would cause you to catch your breath to see somebody who is so remorseless.
Yeah.
So, Saoirse, what's the commission is, when is it due its report and what are we expecting in terms of a time frame?
Yeah, well, that's where we need a crystal ball.
Yeah.
I think the victims had told me they were quite confident that there would be a small window between the testimony concluding this week and the publication of the final report. However, the chairman has now decided that he needs to recall Bill Keneally again after Easter. A date hasn't been set for that, but it would appear there's still a lot more questions to be asked. So that leaves us in the dark. We're not sure at this point how long that will take. But I think the impression I get from the victims is they have waited so long. Yes, they want it to end. They want this done before the summer. They want to try get on with their lives. But at the same time, they've waited so long. I think they're not complaining about another few weeks if it means they get the job done properly. But just on that point regarding the time that it's taking and the timeline for the final report, one of the victims told me that when this started, when he made his first complaint, his son was a newborn. And by the time the report is published, that child will be almost a teenager. So that is a long time to wait for this to end. And I mean, I think he was at pains to stress that his wife has bore the brunt of that. You know, the family have suffered. And that's something I do when I just speak, you know, in conversation with friends or family about this. Like, I always stress that there are families who really, you know, struggled and yet supported their loved ones through all of this. And I think they should be, you know, they should be remembered as being, I guess, the heroes, you know, beside the whistleblowers.
Yeah. I mean, it is 100% true that, you know, justice delayed is justice denied, they used to say. And in fairness, the commission seems to be doing a great job. But I suppose that idea is that the victims come forward and they have to live with this kind of anxiety and fear that it's not going to be heard as it should. But I think we can have some confidence, I think, in how the commission have been going about the work. They do seem to be both compassionate and thorough.
Yeah. And I think as well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, from my perspective, I've never been shy about admitting there are times being a journalist is horrible. You know, there are times to cover stories that you just don't want to cover. You don't want to knock that door, you know. But there's something strangely rewarding about this story because you know that these people want to speak. They were forced into this darkness and this silence for decades. And it was like when they found their voice, they were ready to tell their story. And they told it to the media first. And I always want to stress as well, like there are other like incredible journalists. Barry Roach in the Irish Times, he did the very first interview with Jason Clancy. Damien Tiernan has been, you know, ruthless in his pursuit of this story. Owen Dalton from The Journal, who I don't know quite well, but I've been reading his coverage of the commission and his attention to detail is second to none. And I think those three just need to be singled out. I hate when journalists try to take ownership of a story. This has very much been, you know, where the media have come out and said, you know, we're not going to let the story go. And the victims, to be fair to them, they have kept talking to journalists. They have never shied away. They have used their voice. And just to kind of, I suppose, to put that into context, like these were boys who were told, you know, on the first night or day or night they would be assaulted, there would be photographs taken of them in very vulnerable positions, naked, in pain, you know, with a Polaroid camera. Bill Keneally would wave these photos in front of their face and threaten them, if you ever speak out about this, you know, your friends and your family will see this photo. So that's how hard it was for them to speak out. And yet they continue, that they have, like what they've done is truly, I mean, it's a service to the state. And their motivation, and I could just to stress that again, their motivation this week was not to tell the country how bad this man was and how much they suffered. Their motivation was to tell the country the system has to change. This can't happen again. And they really seem to want to labour that point. And I think that's, you know, it's important to recognise that.
Yes, and no doubt it is. And of course, we'll come back to you, Saoirse, when the commission does reproduce its final report. And thank you very much for speaking to us today and attending for the Sunday World this week at the commission.
Okay. All right. Take care.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com, produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Clodagh Meaney. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review, or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.